what I want to do to begin with is to focus on the idea of motivation. Before I begin, just let me say, is it fair to say that somebody with high motivation, working in a high morale context, a high morale culture, could easily get twice as much work done as somebody whose motivation is rock bottom, working in a low morale culture? Yeah. So can you see how motivation and morale, if you're not careful, can double the workload? Or the absence of motivation and positive high morale can in effect double the workload. So you can then get a vicious circle in the sense that if motivation and morale are low, energy levels are low, so people struggle to get the job done. And if people struggle to get the job done, then they feel great pressure on them. And if they feel great pressure on them, that can then lower their motivation and morale. So do you see how you've then got a vicious circle? That it goes round and round, this sort of negativity of low energy levels, people struggling to get through the job. Now, in social work, the way this can often work is in terms of people not closing cases. I ran a course only a couple of weeks ago where somebody told me that she had 9 cases that were ready for closing, but she hadn't got round to closing them. Do you see how she was carrying this big heavy weight of all these cases on her shoulder, struggling to get through each day, really struggling to like wade through the mud, if you like, of this heavy workload. But you see what had happened there, that was part of a vicious circle. Because what I said to her was, well, if you set aside, say, half a day, the next time you've got half a day completely free in your diary, set that aside for closing those cases and see how much better you feel once you know you've got them done and dusted and out of the way. But do you see how she needed me to say that to her, that she wasn't doing that herself? She was allowing, probably the numbers would have gone up, of cases, well, I've actually finished with that, but I'm too busy working on active open cases to actually do what I need to do to bring it to, you know, like writing a closure summary and stuff like that. So again, a vicious circle can develop which demotivates and demoralizes people, and so they lose control in a sense of their workload. And that's something we'll look at later in the week as well, you know, this sort of self-management or self-leadership issues, and that's where the assertiveness issue comes up as well. So let's have a look at motivation to begin with, and then we'll look at morale a bit later. Motivation, we can look at in terms of a traditional approach to motivation, is to divide it into 3 elements, or 3 forces, if you like. One is motivating factors themselves, the things that actually motivate us, the things that give us that sense of energy, the desire to get something done, to move forward, and so on. And basically, different people have different motivating factors. So what motivates me might not motivate you, and vice versa. And a lot of it is to do with our values. So values can be a significant source of motivation, for example. So one thing to recognise in terms of motivating factors is it can be useful in terms of self-awareness to be clear about what are your motivating factors. What are the things that give you a sense of purpose, a sense of being energised to do something? And then to think about how do you build on those? You know, how do you try and make those a stronger feature of your life, your working life, especially in terms of what we're talking about today? How can you make those motivating factors, the things that give you that buzz, as it were? But then the other side of the coin are demotivating factors, or what are sometimes called drag factors. These are the things that will sap your energy, that will be perhaps unpleasant and demotivating for you. So these are the things that perhaps you don't feel comfortable with. Perhaps you don't feel confident about something. And so that sort of saps your nervous energy, in a sense, of having to deal with it. Or it may just be that it's tedious. It's just something boring that you don't like doing. And again, there's a self-awareness issue there, in the sense that knowing what your demotivating factors are can be helpful, because you can either avoid them where possible, or try and turn them into motivating factors. Try and do something differently. So, for example, if there's something you don't feel confident about, and that then saps your motivation, if you try and see it as a challenge, see it as a learning opportunity, can you see how that could potentially then become something that motivates you? It's very interesting. You know, I often meet people on courses who say, I can't do such and such. You know, I'm not able to do certain things. Like when I run courses on time and workload management, people often say, I'm not well organized. You know, I don't have those skills. As if it's something you're like born with. Do you know what I mean? That you've either got that skill or you haven't. Whereas you can learn how to be well organized. You know, that it's not something magical or mystical or genetic. That being well organized means having a system. And you can develop a system if that's going to help you. So do you see how if being disorganized demotivates you because it causes you problems, then you could then potentially turn it into a motivating factor and say, right, I'm going to take control of my life now. I'm going to empower myself rather than disempower myself by looking at how I can develop a system for managing the demands on me and so on and so forth, so you're more in control. And when we look at stress tomorrow, that will be one of the issues. Control is something we'll look at, because that's very significant in relation to stress. So by getting greater control, you can change then a demotivating factor into a motivating factor. And the key to it, like I say, is self-awareness. But that's not all there is. It's not just motivating factors and demotivating factors. They're also what are known as hygiene factors. Now, this is indirectly linked to the idea of hygiene, as in cleanliness, but not directly. It's by analogy, in a sense. So it's not really to do with keeping stuff clean. A hygiene factor is something which will not necessarily motivate you if it's present, but it will demotivate you if it is absent. Just like cleanliness won't make you healthy, but its absence might make you ill. Can you see how that works? So, think about what might make you demotivated if it's absent, but won't necessarily motivate you if it's present. Consider, for example, having a desk. Can you see how if somebody's got a desk to work from, they're not likely to be motivated by that? I can't imagine, for example, anybody driving to work thinking, fantastic, I've got a desk. It's wonderful. I'm just so revved up. I am so highly motivated because I've got a desk. Oh, my God, I love my desk. It's not likely, is it? Let's face it. But in some places, they have systems whereby you don't have a desk. Yeah, that it's what's called hot desking. So there'll be perhaps, you know, surfaces around the room with chairs next to them and phone plug-in points, you know, phone sockets. So you plug a phone in, plug your phone into that socket or whatever, pull up a chair, and that's your work base for today. But tomorrow somebody else might be sitting there. So can you see how not having a desk, not having the proper facilities, is not likely to motivate anybody, but not having them could demotivate them, where people could, to put it bluntly, feel pissed off that they haven't got a bloody desk. Can you see how that works? So that's an important part of motivation, because sometimes it's the absence of something that is demotivating us. It's not, you know, oh, I find this tedious, it demotivates me. That's a straightforward demotivating factor. A hygiene factor is more complex. It's where there is something that is missing that is demotivating you. Another example would be praise. Can you see how, for some people, praise is a motivating factor? They feel motivated. But for other people, it's a hygiene factor in the sense that they're not necessarily motivated by praise, but they would be demotivated if they didn't get any. So if they're getting it, they take it for granted. But if they're not getting it, then they feel that that's not fair, they're missing out, they're not being appreciated, and so on. So those are the three elements of motivation according to the traditional model: is motivating factors, demotivating factors, hygiene factors. And as I've said, a key to this is self-awareness, being aware of what are these issues and how they affect you, so you can then try and manage them. And that links in with our topic later in the week of self-management and self-leadership, important parts of professionalism. So again, you're not just waiting to be told what to do. You are managing yourself, managing your workload, managing your life in a sense. Gives you greater sense of control, so you're less prone to stress and negativity and so on. Now, before I move on to look at other aspects of motivation, I just want to mention that people often think of money as a motivating factor, whereas in reality, it's a hygiene factor. So can you see how that works, that people won't necessarily be motivated by money, but they may be demotivated if they feel they're not getting fairly rewarded. Imagine, for example, somebody gets promoted. They get more money. Do you think they're going to work harder in their new job than they did in their old job? Not necessarily. Do you see what I mean? Whereas if money was a motivating factor, the more money you get, the harder you would work. And I'm sure you can see, it doesn't follow, does it? You know, in some organisations, for example, the lowest paid people are the hardest workers. Yeah, you might have, say, a cleaner, for example, who's on the minimum wage, who works extremely hard to keep the place spotless. And you might have a senior manager who is on, you know, a very high salary, who just does the bare minimum to get through the day. So do you see how we've got to be careful that we don't oversimplify this thing about motivation and say, oh, it's all about money. It isn't. It's very clearly not the case that it's about money. That's, money's obviously part of it, but to just put it all down to it's about people who are motivated by money, you're oversimplifying some complex issues there. Now then, let's move on now to look at a wider picture, because like I say, that's the traditional model of motivation in terms of those three key sets of factors. But what we're now aware of, you know, in more recent years we've learned, is that there are issues about the social and organisational context that are significant in terms of motivation. So again, it's not just down to individual psychological factors. We've got to be wary of seeing individuals in isolation and not recognising the impact of the wider context. So let's think about how the wider context can influence motivation. Well, one thing is culture. So the culture can motivate or demotivate people. An organisational culture especially can have a significant impact on how motivated people are or how motivated they're not, as the case may be. So, for example, organisations can differ in terms of how much they support learning. How much are they geared towards helping people learn? Some organisations do the bare minimum. You know, they provide statutory training courses that they are obliged by law to provide. You know, perhaps health and safety and stuff like that. They provide the bare minimum and then that's it. They think they've done their job as far as learning is concerned. Other organisations have cultures where learning is a top priority. You know, if you're not learning, you're seen as you're not doing your job properly. So do you see how we're back into cultural differences there? Do you see how that will affect motivation? Whether somebody's being supported in learning and encouraged to learn will affect their motivation to learn. So even somebody whose own personal motivation to learn is fairly low may be part of a culture where that motivation to learn is maximised, whereas somebody who's keen to learn could go into a culture where learning is not encouraged and they very quickly lose their enthusiasm for learning and they become culture victims. So culture can influence motivation. Workplace well-being can also influence motivation. What do I mean by workplace well-being? Well, that's basically how well organisations look after their staff. Whether they provide proper facilities, whether they show appreciation, whether they are open and honest with their staff, or whether they play games. So at the worst level, what you've got is organisations who perhaps make people redundant with a text message. Now, you heard about some of these cases that are featured in the media, you know, newspapers and on TV and so on, stuff about organisations not even telling people personally that they're being made redundant. They just get a text message that basically says, you no longer have a job with us. And you see how in terms of workplace well-being, that's about as bad as it gets, really. Whereas other organisations can be excellent in terms of how well they support and nurture their staff. Part of this, for example, would be bullying. Some organisations will not tolerate bullying at all. The slightest hint of bullying and the matter is dealt with firmly and strongly and promptly. Other organisations, sadly, bullying is part of the culture. It's very common for people to be bullied. So do you see how that's going to influence motivation, in a sense? How well does this organisation actually take seriously the idea that an organisation's most important resource is its human resource, its people? Have you heard that saying, yeah? An organisation's most important resource is its human resource, its people. Because if you haven't got the right technology, you might struggle. If you haven't got the right systems, you might struggle. But if you haven't got the right people, you'll definitely struggle. Can you see how that works? So it's very wise for organisations to take the needs of their staff seriously. And organisations differ significantly in terms of how well they do that. So that will affect motivation. And then last but not least, what will also affect motivation is morale. Now, what's important to recognise is that a lot of people use motivation and morale interchangeably, as if it's the same thing. Morale, motivation, morale, same difference, whereas it isn't. There is actually an important distinction between motivation and morale. And that distinction is that motivation is a psychological matter, morale is a sociological matter. Okay, so motivation is about you personally, you individually. Each one of you in this room will have your own level of motivation for your own personal reasons. Those will be influenced by the wider context, of course, but they will be personal to you. They will be individual psychological matters. Whereas morale is about shared motivation. It's about the culture of motivation. So can you see what I'm getting at? That's a sociological matter. It's shared issue. So you can have somebody, for example, with high motivation in a low morale culture. They will struggle to keep that motivation high, but it is possible to do that. Or you may have the other way around. You may have a high morale culture, but somebody whose motivation within that is low. And that's often the person that other people complain about. Yeah, they say, here we are all pulling together, supporting each other, and look at so-and-so, they're just doing the bare minimum. So can you see the difference between motivation and morale, but how they're interlinked? They influence one another. Of course, what I should mention is that motivation will change. Can you see how you can wake up one morning, you know, feeling not too wonderful and your motivation's rock bottom? You wake up another morning, you just feel good. And so on. So, you know, motivation will fluctuate, but it will normally stay within a certain range. You know, the difference between somebody's minimum level of motivation and maximum is not going to be that great, you know, over a week or over a month or whatever. But, as I say, it'll be influenced by wider factors, including morale. So let's have a look at morale. And the first point I want to emphasise is that morale is linked to leadership and culture. As a sociological phenomenon, it's linked to things like culture. So you get individuals who can rate themselves or be rated by other people in terms of levels of motivation. But you can look at a culture in terms of the morale. Is it high morale? Is it medium morale? Is it low morale? What is it? And again, it can differ significantly. You know, the difference between a low morale culture and a high morale culture can be an enormous gulf, really. So that's worth knowing about. And again, morale, in a sense, is partly down to leadership, because leaders, and I, you know, including managers and professionals as leaders, part of leadership is influencing a culture in a positive direction. So tolerating low morale, accepting low morale as inevitable, do you see how that's an example of poor or non-existent leadership? If people just say, oh, well, that's the way it is, you know, that people are not very motivated, that people are not very happy, it's a miserable place to work, people just accept it, that's actually a failure of leadership in a sense, because it can be changed, cultures can be changed, as we've noted. So, what's also important is that high morale encourages commitment and engagement, which then has a positive effect on performance, on quality and quantity of work. So that if you've got a situation of high morale, people are more likely to feel part of what's going on, they're going to feel that they belong, they're going to want to do a good job, they're going to want to be successful because they're part of what they see as an important enterprise, that, you know, we're in this together, it may be tough, it may be difficult, may be demanding, we may have certain problems, but what we're doing is important, we're supporting each other through this. That's what high morale can do. But by contrast, low morale can be poisonous. And what I mean by poisonous is that it sort of like pollutes or destroys good stuff. It harms aspects of working life that could otherwise be positive. So where you've got a culture of low morale, for example, then you will get reduced performance. So quality and quantity of work will go down where there is low morale. And see how that's back to the vicious circle then. You know, when the quality and quantity of work goes down, then people struggle to get through their workload. And when they struggle to get through their workload, they feel fed up. And when they feel fed up, then that contributes to low morale. So that's quite significant. You get reduced performance. You get a higher error rate as well. In other words, people make more mistakes in a low morale culture. Can you see how that would work? You know, if people are basically fed up, there's little or no energy and commitment to the job, a lot of negativity. Can you see how mistakes are going to be more likely in that context than in a high morale culture? You know, concentration levels are going to be lower, for example. There's also going to be a greater likelihood of stress. So people actually suffering as a result of the level of pressure, being made ill, for example, by the level of pressure, is more likely if there is low morale. Now, people can feel as though they're in this sort of swamp, you know, that they are stuck in this swamp of negativity, and they feel then that there's nothing they can do to get out of it, so they can get stressed by that, it can make them ill. And that could be physical illness, or it could be in terms of mental health problems that would emerge. You can have that. Because in a sense, as I mentioned, mental health problems, a low morale culture is almost like a collective depression. That there's just as if, you know, a whole group of people has slid into this negativity, defeatism, cynicism, everything, you know, they've just given up on before they've even tried. And then what that can lead to then, because of the stress, is higher levels of sickness absence. You see how we're back to vicious circles there again? Because if you've got higher levels of sickness absence, that puts more pressure on the people who remain. And if there's more pressure on the people who remain when their morale is already low, do you see how that's going to lower morale even further? So we're back into these destructive cycles, these vicious circles again. You can also get recruitment and retention problems. If a place becomes such a dreadful atmosphere to work in, do you see how a lot of people will leave? People will move on at the earliest opportunity. But you can also get a situation where it affects the reputation of that particular organisation or that team. You may have come across this, you know, where perhaps there are constantly vacancies in a particular team because people keep leaving because it's a dreadful culture to work in, you know, a low morale culture. And then what happens is they find it really difficult to recruit people because word gets round. Only go and work there if you're desperate. Yeah. If you can't pay your mortgage, go and work there. But if you're not desperate, then that's the last place you should work because the morale there is rock bottom. It's a dreadful atmosphere to work in. Do you see how reputations can be damaged by low morale? And that is, you know, not uncommon for that to happen, for, you know, for people to tip each other off. Oh, I did a placement there. Don't go near it with a barge pole. And that sort of thing. So recruitment and retention problems can happen, and then that puts more pressure on the remaining staff, and then keeps the morale low. There can also be obstacles to learning. If people are sitting around moaning all the time, low levels of energy, struggling to get through the day, this sort of collective depression, do you see how there's not going to be much learning going on in a situation like that? So somebody could be in a team like that for, say, 3 years and learn absolutely nothing. That's 3 full years of their career totally wasted. That the next job they go into, they're not going to be the slightest bit better at it because they learned nothing during that 3 years, because they were just locked into this culture of low morale with its low energy levels, its low learning. I think what people learn is often, if they learn anything at all, is bad stuff. It's like defensive practice. They learn how to cover their back. And as I've said so many times to so many different groups of people, the huge danger with defensive practice is that you're not focusing on what you should be focusing on. So like in child protection, for example, if people are being defensive because they don't want to get their name in the newspaper, so they're focusing on not getting their name in the newspaper, what are they not focusing on? The child. And if they're not focusing on the child, what risk do they run? Getting their name in the newspaper. Do you see what I'm getting at? So that's why defensive practice is bad practice. It's about professional accountability, as we were saying yesterday. It's about being able to... So if people learn anything in a low morale culture, it's likely to be bad habits that they learn, which are then not going to help them in the next job, in fact may hinder them in the next job if they are going to take those habits with them in a sense. Okay, so can you see how low morale will block learning in a sense? That's quite significant. And also what you'll get with low morale is increased conflict. Can you see if there's low morale, there'll be tension? And if there's tension, do you see how easy it is for people then end up sparring off each other, in a sense? You know, that conflicts will develop because there's not much energy, but there is a lot of tension. It's easy then for people to start niggling each other and for tensions and conflicts to develop. And what we'll look at later in the module is that conflict is not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be a bad thing. So we don't want to be encouraging conflict necessarily. And then last but not least in terms of morale, what you get is defeatism and cynicism, where people have this sort of tainted approach to things. They see everything through a negative light. You know, this idea of, is the glass half empty or is it half full? And of course, the short answer to that is it's half empty and it's half full. You know, there are lots of positives and lots of negatives, and we need to deal with both. But what you get in a low morale culture is people only see the negatives. They see the glass as half empty. They don't see it as half full. And that can be quite significant. So you get this very negative perception of situations. So a classic example of this in a team culture with low morale, for example, would be, imagine a team that are not happy with something, whatever that may be, and they raise the issue with senior managers. They say, we're not happy about X, Y, or Z, whatever it might be. And it takes the senior managers 6 months before they put it right, before they change whatever needs changing. Now, do you see how, if they've got what they want, if the team's got what they want, they should be celebrating that, shouldn't they? They should be seeing that as positive, saying, great, this was really bothering us. We raised it with senior managers, and it's taken a while, but we've got there now. We've got that change made while we want. Great, cause for celebration. But no, in a culture with low morale, what you're likely to get is people saying, 6 bloody months. It took those bastards 6 bloody months to make that change. Isn't it bloody pathetic? Can you see what I'm getting at? That's the defeatism, that's the cynicism, that's it. You know, so instead of celebrating their success, they focus on the negative that it took 6 months to get that success. And that, in a way, is classic. You know, that's characteristic of low morale, is people just see the negatives of what they have in those situations. Highly problematic stuff, so that it can cause huge problems in terms of the impact it has on individual workers, the effect on service users, our clientele. Can you see how, who's going to lose out in terms of low morale, as well as the actual people who are suffering low morale at the time? Yeah. You see how that's going to work? They're going to get a lower level of service. They are going to get people who are not firing on all cylinders, that who are perhaps just about struggling to function. You're going to get what I referred to in an earlier session as semi-burnt out people. People who are just doing the minimum to, they're focusing on surviving, not thriving. And see how that then is contrary to professionalism. Professionalism is about thriving. How do we do the best job in difficult circumstances is what professionalism is about. How can we be committed to making a positive difference to some of the most vulnerable, disadvantaged members of our community? That's a professional approach to the challenges we face. But just doing the bare minimum to get through, just focusing on surviving, do you see how that's not compatible with professionalism? But sadly, it's not uncommon for that to happen. Okay, so that's the picture I wanted to paint for you of motivation and morale. And hopefully you can see how motivation and morale are separate, but they're linked. Yeah, so motivation is about the individual psychological factors linked to stuff like self-awareness, self-management. How much control have you got over your own life? Or have you disempowered yourself by letting go of things you can control? and we'll come back to that when we look at stress issues, or is it that you have got, you know, a fuller control over your motivation, about being clear about what makes you tick, and building on that? That's separate from but linked to the idea of morale, which is a sociological thing about how people interact and how cultures develop, which become very powerful influences on not just behaviour, but as we saw earlier, also our thoughts and feelings. I mean, as I think I mentioned yesterday, I've been lucky that I've had the opportunity to go to other countries and work with social work professionals and educators in those countries. And in particular, I've been to India 3 times. Now, in this country, I constantly hear people moaning that we haven't got enough resources, yeah, that we haven't got enough services to provide for people. Now, in India, that's not an issue, because it's not about we haven't got enough. They haven't got any. Do you see what I'm getting at? Social workers work with families and communities to empower them to address their issues. They can't refer them to another agency or put them on a waiting list for a service or whatever, because I'm not saying they don't exist at all, but they barely exist. So do you see how that's an issue? Going to India made me appreciate what we've got in this country. Do you see what I'm getting at? I was almost on a daily basis hearing people saying it's disgraceful the way the welfare state is underfunded, we haven't got enough money for this, and I would agree with that. You know, I think that is a backward step that has been taken. But you have to put that in context, you have to put that in perspective. In some other countries, what we've got is just luxurious by comparison with what's available in other countries. And yet, this may strike you as surprising, and yet what I found in India was morale amongst Indian social workers was far, far higher than British social workers. Yeah, that there were a group of people who were like rolling their sleeves up, getting stuck in to make a positive difference in extremely difficult circumstances, and then, you know, going home at the end of the day thinking, yeah, there's a lot wrong, there's a lot that could be better, but thinking, I made a difference today. I worked hard in difficult circumstances, and I feel knackered now, but it was important work that I did, and I did my best in difficult circumstances to make a positive difference. Can you see how that's very different from the attitude that you get a lot amongst a lot of people in this country? But also, I think there's also the issue about expectations. I think what's happened in this country is because we have had a strong welfare state at times in the past, many people then seem to develop the idea that in social work and social care that we can have 100% success rate. And so if there's somebody's needs we can't meet, we see it then as a failure. And I think, you know, that is unhelpful in a sense. You know, that it's we're setting ourselves up to fail if we have this idea that we should be able to help everybody and sort out everybody's needs. You know, that discussion we had about a sedimentation model, about where the expectation is that we should fill all the gaps that are left by other organisations and other agencies, now saying that's just unrealistic. We can't meet everybody's needs. And when we look at stress issues, I think, you know, that's an important factor in stress, because a lot of stress comes from people setting themselves up to fail. You know, that I've come across, for example, social workers who are very upset because they can't meet somebody's needs. But who said you should be able to meet everybody's needs? Where did that idea come from? It's become part of a professional culture, in a sense. Even though it's not justified, it's this idea that it's our job to meet everybody's needs. And if we don't meet everybody's needs, then we have failed in some way, and we should feel bad about that. But if you think about child protection, is it realistic that we can ever develop a society where no child is abused? So do you see how it doesn't matter how brilliant we may be in our work, we have to face up to the sad, tragic reality that we can only do our best in difficult circumstances, we cannot guarantee success. And because if you think about it, there's only one profession that has 100% success rate. Anybody know what that profession is?
Undertakers.
Undertakers, exactly, yeah. Funeral directors are the only profession that have 100% success rate. Can you imagine how stressful it would be for the police if they went about their business on the expectation that they can clear up every crime? Can you imagine how they would just get drowned, wouldn't they, in pressure, from self-imposed pressure, with the sense that they can clear up every crime? Because I hope this doesn't happen to any of you, but let's imagine if any of you come by car today and you've parked your car somewhere where there's no CCTV and somebody damages your car and there's no witnesses. What are the chances of the police resolving that crime, do you think? No CCTV, no witnesses. It's virtually nil, isn't it? So do you see how it would be horrendous, wouldn't it, for the police if they got stressed out because there's nothing they can do about the fact that your car got vandalised, say, by somebody. So they have to accept that their job is not to clear up every crime. That's unrealistic. Their job is to do the best they can in difficult circumstances. And you see how that's what applies to social work as well. So whether it's in India with few resources or in the UK with much more but arguably still not enough resources, do you see how it's still the same issue? It's about doing the best you can in difficult circumstances, not setting yourself up to fail by expecting that you should be able to help all people in all circumstances. Because one of the things that's important to think about in terms of stress, I don't want to say too much about stress because we're going to do a session specifically on that tomorrow, but one of the key issues around stress is expectations. Because a lot of stress comes from expectations. Either when those expectations are unrealistic, you know, when other people are setting you up to fail, or you're setting yourself up to fail by giving yourself an unrealistic target to aim for, or expectations can be stressful when they're not clear, when you don't know what's expected of you. Yeah, you ever been in that situation where, you know, you don't really know what you're supposed to be doing, and then somebody says, oh, well, perhaps if you just do this, then it's, oh, I feel so much better, now I know what I'm supposed to be doing. So unclear expectations can be stressful, but also contradictory expectations can be stressful. And that's another key factor in social work, you know, that often what your organisation expects and what a family you're working with, for example, expects may be very different. And you then have to manage that without putting yourself in a situation where you get stressed by it. So do you see how expectations are quite significant? In fact, in my Practicing Social Work, Meeting the Professional Challenge book, there's a chapter on managing expectations. And you know what we were saying about setting out your stall? Do you see how that's an example of managing expectations? You set out your stall, you're managing expectations. You're saying, I can do this, but I can't do that. This is my job, but that's not my job, and so on. And that's part of the process of staying sane, in a sense, is, you know, having clarity about where your job begins and ends, rather than just being a general helper to whoever wants it in whatever circumstances, where you can just get stretched very easily to the point where you break. Organisations can be dangerous places. Yeah. So it's important that when we're talking about support and supporting each other, that we include managers in that. You know, it's about moving away from the sort of us-them mentality of, you know, we are the wage slaves, they're the managers, any organisational problems, they get paid more than we do, so it's up to them to sort it out. Do you see how that clashes with professionalism? If we see ourselves as professionals, then managers are fellow professionals. We should be working with managers as fellow professionals to move things forward positively. And then we don't have to worry about things like, well, if I suggest something, will I get slapped down? Because if you're suggesting it as a fellow professional to other professionals, and you're doing it assertively rather than, you know, in a stroppy way, then why should you get slapped down for it? Do you see what I'm getting at? But if you have that sort of bureaucratic model of they're the bosses, and you put it as forward as if you're telling them how to do their job, do you see how that's when you might get slapped down? So a lot of it comes back to, you know, what is the model we are working on here? Do we see our role as a sort of welfare bureaucrat role, where we're basically doing what the boss wants us to do, or do we see ourselves as professionals working with fellow senior professionals to achieve the same ends, you know, that we're basically on the same side, that we're all trying to do the best we can in difficult circumstances. Okay, we've run out of time, but thanks for your efforts. Hope you feel that was worth it.